Well, from Verdi to Monty Python, the Inquisition seems to have consistently got a pretty bad rap. The Inquisition, by the Inquisition I mean those early processes and the later institutions, starting around the 12th century onwards, which were set up to deal with the problem of heresy, initially in southern France and northern Italy and other parts of Europe, and later being taken over by national kings and states to form institutional inquisitions, particularly in Spain. The Inquisition, as I said, has had a pretty bad rap, and the terminology, the term that we use for this bad rap is often the black legend. The black legend of an Inquisition which was omnipotent, supranational, controlling, intolerant, more powerful even than kings and popes. This is, for reasons I will outline, the complete reverse of the truth. The term black legend, incidentally, was coined in 1914 by a Castilian nationalist historian who was fed up with his beloved country being defamed by Protestant and progressive historians. The trend in the historiography of the Inquisition is positive, however. New records, new archives, new material, and new evidence is becoming increasingly available, and this is turning the tide of historical writing against the black legend, against this legend of a devilish Inquisition. Some writers would talk of the sire, the lord of the Inquisitors, being Satan himself. This bad press was, to no small degree, to do with not only anti-Catholic, but really anti-Spanish sentiment. Around the time of the invention of the black legend, Spain was a major power, and it was the major Catholic power. And while the Catholic powers tended to fight militarily, the Protestant powers really unleashed the new weapon of the printing press, which led to documents, to propaganda, such as, and this is a wonderful title, propaganda pieces such as, quote, this is the title, "A discovery and plain declaration of the sundry and subtle practices of the Holy Inquisition of Spain," written in 1567 and translated pretty quickly thereafter into a number of languages. Within these propaganda documents, which have really set the agenda, set the tone of historical writing, as I said, until recently, we have this image of hooded fanatical monks with a fetish for torture, for whippings and scourgings, and rather sadistic about it, with the famed medieval Inquisition, medieval and early modern Inquisition torture chamber, with these wonderful things, like the so-called Iron Maiden, where you would be put into this thing, and 1,000 little knives would be thrust into you, and you'd be cut into as many pieces. Or the Inquisition was said to roast victims' feet, or to brick them up permanently behind a wall, or to smash them with hammers, or to flail them, or even to rape their female victims. And this pretty gruesome legend is wonderful. It's a good story, and we like good stories, and we like, as Dermot McCulloch put it, Dermot McCulloch's a good historian of Christian history, we like tidy-minded history. We like our own narratives, we like stories and structures and so on of our own construction, and we don't really care if they fit the facts. We want the facts to fit them. And but McCulloch cautions us against tidy-minded historian cautions us to look for the nuance. We particularly like clash of civilization narratives, whether it's the brilliant European against the Turk or whatever. We like these narratives, but they often fail, but they make us feel good. What I propose to do for roughly the first half of this talk is to deal with some common misconceptions, some common myths of the Reformation. And then later, hopefully if I have time, to go into some details of what the Inquisition was actually up against. If you like, you can see it as the rebutting of myth and then trying to make, perhaps more controversially, a positive case for the need for a Reformation as, terrible Freudian slip, for an Inquisition as such. One of the headings I've decided to put the myths or the misconceptions of the Inquisition under is the violence or the cruelty of the Inquisition. The idea that the Inquisition tortured most of its victims, if you like, or that it killed an awful lot of them. I'm afraid this is not true. The torture chambers that we think about largely did not exist. Torture was pretty rare. Stephen Talixer, one of the revisionist historians, says that in Valencia, for instance, out of 7,000 cases of the Inquisition, only 2% ever experienced any torture at all. And this was very rarely for more than 15 minutes. Repeat torture was particularly rare. And we're now familiar with the reasons, with the limitations on Inquisition torture. We're familiar now with the facts that torture was limited. It could not be excessively brutal, and that medical experts had to be present and would intervene if the torture got out of hand. Medieval inquisitors who were not stupid knew that a confession obtained as a result of torture was not valid, and so they would cease the torture, and they would only regard any confessions as valid which had been obtained again. They would ask, "Are you sure you're a heretic?" However, violent torture and punishment was common throughout Europe, and was much more common. We see these days, as a result of the new research, we find that violent torture was more common outside the tribunals and the methods of the Inquisition. And this is true also of punishments. The allegation that the Inquisition killed an awful lot of its victims is again simply not true. Oh, and by the way, before I go into that, that the so-called Iron Maiden did not exist. There are some that we have, but they were largely produced elsewhere. One that I know of was produced in Germany, where the Inquisition was pretty much non-existent. When it comes to deaths as a result of Inquisition punishment, again, the medieval Inquisition would only kill about 5% overall of those it dealt with. And the Spanish Inquisition, in the Spanish Inquisition, when we're talking about Protestants only, fewer Protestants died in Inquisition countries, so to speak, than in other countries. About 40 or 50 in 16th century Spain, and you compare that with other countries which did not have the Inquisition. You compare that with England, where about 400 people died in England for religious reasons. That's quite a big difference. Over the entire existence of the Inquisition, of the Spanish Inquisition, which is about 350 years, we're looking at a much lower figure than we originally thought of deaths. We're looking at about 3,000 to 5,000. And again, the stake, the execution method, the stake was used by the secular powers, and it was used in countries where the Inquisition did not exist. So when it comes to cruel methods and cruel punishment, this was reserved really for those who were obstinate heretics, those who would who refused to repent, and those who were repeat offenders, so to speak, and they and the methods were much less severe than we thought. To take another sort of category of allegations and misconceptions about the Inquisition, that the Inquisition was fanatical and represented an intolerant mindset. This again is perhaps harder to argue against. However, there were one or two things that we can say here. First of all, the image, the mythical image that we have of hooded demons who happened often to be Dominican friars who had this terrible interest in torture is largely inaccurate. The inquisitors of the Inquisition did not need to be priests. They were legal experts and often in a fairly early stage of their career and would later go on to rise through bureaucracies or other things. But bureaucracies and bureaucrats don't make quite the same supervillains as monks with brutal torture methods. Another point which I think is quite interesting, if not conclusive, but it's good to sort of think about, is that the Inquisition did not necessarily flourish in places where you would expect. Spain is an interesting example. Now, the Inquisition was set up in different places to deal with different problems, different types of heresy. In Spain, it was largely a problem of making sure that conversos, those who had converted from the Jewish faith or the Islamic faith, were properly Christian, and trying to ensure some kind of religious unity. However, Spain has many signs, if not of being an incredibly tolerant country, at least has long had signs of being a pluralistic country. And this sometimes suggested a kind of tolerance, and sometimes even to the point of indifferentism about religious matters. For example, there's this wonderful example of a priest in Soria in 1490 who said, and I quote, "There are three faiths, and I don't know which is the best." It's remarkable. And this priest went on to affirm that, quote, "I think that everyone can be saved in his own faith," unquote. And there were, throughout Europe, not just in Spain, definitely examples of people changing from one faith to another and associating quite closely with members of other faiths, would have maybe a Jewish physician, and there were Arabic chairs, Arabic professors, and Hebrew professors in universities across Europe. Another similar example to the one I mentioned before, but not from Spain, is this quite charming example from Italy. There was a northern Italian miller called Menocchio, who was pressed in 1584 by one of the Italian inquisitors on the subject of which was the true religion, and he replied, quote, "God the Father has various children whom he loves, such as Christians, Turks," by which he meant Muslims, "and Jews, and to each of them he has given the will to live by his own law, and we do not know which is the right one." It's remarkable, you don't associate these sorts of views with people in the Middle Ages, but these sorts of, I'm not suggesting they were common, but tolerant or not intolerant views certainly existed in Europe, and I therefore think that the idea that Europe was, that the Inquisition represented a persecuting society is difficult to sustain to the extent that we sometimes like to. There's also, on the topic of whether the Inquisition was fanatical, there's also the argument to be made that the Inquisition was quite rational and enlightened in its legal practices and methods. On the topic of witchcraft, which we often erroneously associate with the Inquisition, on the topic of witchcraft, the Inquisitions were very skeptical, because they were lawyers and they were university men, and they would look for evidence. So if there was an allegation that this woman has murdered my babies, it's quite simple. They would look and say, well, where are the bodies of these babies? And more often than not, it was incredibly difficult to find evidence for alleged witchcraft. And often beyond that, the inquisitors believed that the concept of witchcraft was, it verged on the imaginary and the delusional. And so the Spanish Inquisition in particular would not try anyone for witchcraft. When I said that their methods were quite rational, I mean really that we have to compare the Inquisition with what came before in terms of legal methods, and also in terms of what was going on at the same time in other tribunals. But the Inquisition resurrected some relatively rational and sensible legal practices from the old Roman law. Previously, the secular courts and some ecclesiastical courts would take third-party accusations, and this would be followed by the process of an ordeal, a trial by fire or what have you. Sometimes there were methods based on trust, but these were also not perfect. And so in a sense, the idea was to try to prove one's innocence, which we now understand as quite perverse. The Inquisition was different. I mean, thought experiment, the word Inquisition, it sounds scary, doesn't it? But compare it with the word Reformation. Inquisition, Reformation, the two words, one sounds scary and one sounds enlightened and wonderful, whereas the reverse is pretty much true. To inquire, to investigate, to look for evidence and to seek knowledge. These are a sort of, if you like, synonyms for an Inquisition, which was a fairly, at the time, sophisticated legal process based on criminal investigation methods. We have criminal investigation departments still today using much the same methods as the Inquisitions. And importantly, the Inquisitions and the later institutional Inquisitions were effective. Their aims were not to inflict pain, their aims were not to kill people or even to terrorize people. Their aims, their aim was quite simple, to reconcile people with the church and with society, which was largely seen as one in the Middle Ages. Of course, that's not perfect. It's not perfect to have a compulsory society, which is what the medieval church, by some historians, has been described as. But of course, the modern state is also a compulsory society. One you enter involuntarily by virtue of being born into it, and another you enter involuntarily by being baptized into it. Neither is perfect. But the Inquisition sought to reconcile people with society and with the church. I could continue, but I'm getting pressed for time. Then the third myth I want to briefly deal with, this myth of the Inquisition as being powerful beyond measure. This is where Verdi comes in. Verdi wrote a very popular opera based on a relative of the King of Spain, where the hero is this relative of the King of Spain who was treated quite appallingly. It's all based on lies. It's a good opera, but it's pretty poor historically. The idea that the Inquisition was so powerful that it might cause a king to kill one of his own relatives is pretty much impossible. It's a nonsense. The Inquisition did have influence, definitely, and it's and the ceremonies, if you like, the rituals whereby heretics would be accused and tried and sentenced and so on would be quite grandiose and quite grand, in particular the so-called acts of faith. But also present at the acts of faith were other members of society, other important members of society, other church authorities and secular authorities and lords. Within this background, within this structure, the Inquisition had to function within a complex and multi-jurisdictional Europe, within an ordered anarchy, if you like. And the Inquisition often struggled to make its voice heard. It was just one, where it was a royal institutional court, it was just one of many, even of those. The Inquisition was also limited in terms of its power when it came to geography. It was often overstretched and under-resourced. There are quite, again, charming cases of inquisitors making the long trek into the countryside to try to bring the Inquisition to the countryside, and peasants would not have heard of this Inquisition. I mean, that's a serious limitation. If you can imagine some drug lord and the police turn up at his house and imagine that this drug lord hasn't heard of, who are you? I've not heard of this police force. And imagine that working, crucially. That was often the situation in the countryside in medieval Spain and elsewhere. And so that's a serious limitation. In my remaining sort of portion, I think I'll turn now to heresy itself and to try to make a positive case for the suppression of heresy, the suppression of the people and the ideas which the Inquisition was designed to, with which the Inquisition was designed to deal. Now, there were various types of heresy. They weren't uniform at all. There were some that were less important and some that were more important. There were academic heresies, often Christian heresies which veered in metaphysics a bit too far towards Plato or a bit too far towards Aristotle. These were dealt with by synods and bishops and so forth, and didn't cause too much trouble. There were also what Margaret Deansley, the church historian, describes as simply pathological heresies. These were sort of misfits, strange people who acted quite strangely. There were the nudists, the atomists, who conducted their religious rites in what we might call a state of nature and caused great consternation by doing so. There were also the flagellants, from which we get the word flagellate. And this is from Deansley, quote, "The flagellants made their appearance in the 13th century, but were more important during the Black Death. Strings of penitents marched through Hungary, Flanders, Germany, Holland, chanting and each man scourging or whipping the shoulders of the man in front." Again, pretty odd behaviour, but not quite so dangerous. And then there were the dancing heretics who would dance about rhythmically until they sank down exhausted. And then someone would shout, "Again, again," and they'd start again. Again, not quite the sort of thing we associate with the Inquisition. Really, the Inquisition was set up in response to the Cathar and Waldensian heresies in southern France and northern Italy, and the Inquisition only really got going when these heresies had become dangerous. There's a common thread really between which you can see through most of these heresies, which I think is illustrated best by turning now to a man who's already been quoted, Erich von Kuhnert-Lodin, whose wonderful book Leftism, or in another edition Leftism Revisited, not only examines leftism in the abstract but leftism throughout history and its political, philosophical, and in this case, what is important, theological origins. He refers to the medieval heresies and heretics who were the reason for the first Inquisitions as, quote, insidious religious sects with leftist social and political programs. He writes of the Waldensians, for instance, who were the followers of a guy called Peter Waldo, who was a rich man who decided to sell everything and then advocate very extreme forms of poverty and denounce wealth, and denounce in particular the property and wealth of the church, and try to get people to act on that basis. Von Kuhnert-Lodin writes of the Waldensians, quote, "The object of their scorn was not only the rich, sinful church, but also all the high and mighty, luxury, ostentation, and power." Likewise, there were Manichaean dualist heretics, those who basically believed that there was one God who created the spiritual world and the spiritual principle, and another God or thing that had created the material world. One was bad, one was good, quite simple. Christianity has always had this dualist streak within it, and a lot of heresies have resulted from it. And Christianity has been at its best when it's controlled that rather puritanical, ascetical streak. And he writes of the Manichaeans in northern Italy, in southern France, Belgium and Bohemia, and even to some extent in England. And he says that they had, quote, apocalyptic visions of the wickedness of wealth. He reminds us also of the later heretics, the later medieval heretics, in England, John Wycliffe, and in Bohemia, Jan Hus, and his more moderate followers, the Hussites, and his more extreme followers, the Taborites. And he talks about these in interesting terms. He teases out the political from the theological. He reminds us of their democratic, essentially democratic theories, and their denunciation, again, of all wealth. And he writes of the Lollards, which were a related sect to both the Wycliffeites and the Bohemian heretics. He writes of these heretics, quote, "Their basic psychological drive was material and intellectual envy," unquote. Attacking the wealth of the church and further spreading this semi misconception. It's more about what you do with this particular idea that's problematic. But further embedding this idea, this legend that Christ was a pauper, and that he was merely the indigent son of a poor carpenter, and that his followers were also all paupers who never owned any property, and who saw property and wealth as somehow tainted and contagious and infectious. Von Kuhnert-Lodin teases out and addresses the anti-intellectual sort of bent to this, to these heresies. The view that intelligence was bad because it was the private property of those who possessed it. And so to turn briefly to the Taborites, the most radical of the later medieval heretics. The Taborites attacked the hierarchical image of God and Pope and Father as Father. And they had all these other sort of extreme ascetic tendencies, and this anti-wealth and anti-hierarchy tendency, and the anti-intellectualism. But they also... and this is also true, I think, of Wycliffe, combined their extreme egalitarianism, their envious egalitarianism, with national hatred, with nationalism, nationalism did not exist by and large in the Middle Ages. It's towards the end of the Middle Ages and with the rise of states that you start to see it. And John Wycliffe and Jan Hus were both responsible really for outbreaks of national hatred and for nationalist movements. Wycliffe, von Kunert Ledin describes as an English furster, and Hus was the spokesman for a kind of Czech nationalism. And so Erik von Kunert Ledin says, quote, the stage for leftist mass movements was set in this most extreme distillation of the medieval heresies, which emerges in the 14th and 15th centuries, with these fanatical, militaristic, socialistic, envious, egalitarian, and apocalyptic heretics. He sees, and I quote, here we have a real and concrete prefiguration of all the isms of our own times in a dynamic synthesis. And then he goes on to quote Proudhon, who says, who points out how interesting it is, and nevertheless surprising, how at the bottom of politics one always finds theology. And von Kunert Ledin says that this can be applied to both medieval and early modern and modern politics. These socialistic and communistic and indeed fascistic heresies were attempts at substitutes for religion, and we're all familiar today with how communist regimes attempt to stamp out all forms of religion. And we have here an earlier medieval and early modern version of that, since these heresies were incompatible with all the great religions, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. And so contrary to popular misconception, the medieval heresies and the Reformation, and by the way, the heretics, if you like, of the Reformation, claimed as their antecedents many of these medieval heretics. And they, you know, what one argument commonly made against Protestantism is, well, how come you're all Johnny come latelys? How come you've only come about 1500 years after Christ? And their answer around the Reformation was, oh, well, the true church has always existed. And they point to these medieval heretics and identify themselves with them. But far from the Reformation being the beginnings of liberalism, as Whiggish and Anglophone history tends to argue, von Kunert Ledin and others make it quite clear that heresy, particularly late medieval heresy, and Protestantism, are best seen as reactions against Christian Renaissance humanism. And with that, I think I'll sum up that the Inquisition was certainly not as cruel, certainly not as fanatical, and certainly not as powerful as it has been claimed to be. But where it did not exist, England, and to a large degree, Bohemia, you see the emergence of the antecedents of the modern left, which, if that's not a flawless argument for the good done by the Inquisition, it at least helps to explain explain why we should be perhaps moderately sympathetic to it and see it as an earlier version of the need stressed by Professor Hopper to enforce some form of orthodoxy to sustain any society. I mean, like the poor, heretics are always with us, and it's just a question of working out what is orthodoxy and what is heresy. and how best to sustain any society. But with that, before I start sounding like a Catholic Hitler, I think I'll close. Thank you very much.